From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Mitch Albom is a sports writer and novelist and author of the world's best-selling memoir, Tuesdays with Maury.
Welcome to Craft, Mitch Albom.
Oh, thanks for having me on the program.
You have a new book out, following up on many of your other successful books like Tuesdays with Maury, and you have The First Phone Call from Heaven, which is a novel. So what was your elevator pitch for this new book?
The basic story is about a small town in northern Michigan that one day wakes up with the phones ringing, and it's people calling from heaven. It only happens to a handful of people, and it only happens in this one little town, no place else on the planet. And the book follows what happens when the story gets out, and people start flocking to the town and descending on it, and everybody wants to be part of the same thing, and the media gets a hold of it, and it becomes bigger and bigger, and meanwhile, there's one guy in the town who is kind of disillusioned. He was in prison for something he didn't do. His wife died while he was there, so he believes in nothing at all. And his little son comes home one day from school and says, "Daddy, when is Mommy going to call us from heaven?" And enraged that his son is being filled with what he thinks is false hope, he sets out to prove the whole thing is some kind of massive hoax. And the book sort of gallops along as he's digging and digging and digging in that area. And meanwhile, the story is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it all kind of culminates with a big clash just before Christmas with a planned for broadcast of the actual first phone call from heaven that everyone in the world is going to listen in on, and they're going to watch on TVs and computers around the world. It's going to settle this question of the afterlife once and for all, just as it seems that he has cracked the mystery of the whole thing. And if I tell you any more, the book will be destroyed.
Right,
so
right.
I'll stop right there.
And you've also got some stories about Alexander Graham Bell interspersed to parallel some of the action in the book.
It's sort of a parallel story of the invention of the telephone, which I really didn't intend to do when I first started writing the book. But as I looked into it, I became so fascinated by these parallels to the story I was telling and what really happened with the invention of the telephone, which was Alexander Graham Bell was not trying to invent a device to allow people to speak across the world. He was trying to help his deaf wife learn how to speak. He was an elocution teacher, amongst everything else, and he taught the deaf. And it was a device that was measuring the vocal vibrations from the throat and then through a sort of earpiece down through a wire that would move a pen that would make a mark. And that's what he was trying to do, and he just sort of realized, wait, I can take this sound and put it through a wire, and electricity can attach to the wire, and then I can spread it around the world, and thus the telephone was born. But he was really just trying to help someone speak to him face-to-face. And, in fact, the very first phone call that was ever conducted was between him and his assistant, Mr. Watson. And he said to him, 20 feet away from a different room, over this little device called a telephone, "Come here, I want to see you." That was the first sentence ever spoken on a telephone, which
right.
is kind of ironic since he had just invented a device that allowed you not to be seen when you were speaking. So there was just all these sort of things that the phone, you know, came from this place of trying to bring people together, and yet in modern society it sort of keeps us apart. You know, we text. We Facebook, we Instagram with our phones, we do all kinds of things with these phones, but speak. And, you know, I was trying to sort of celebrate the human connection through the voice, and so that's where that parallel story kind of worked well.
Right. You know, one of the interesting things that I learned in the book was that he started off working on cadavers, Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah, person's ear was
right.
The first model of a telephone. Yeah, well, you think about it, I mean... There's an ear always involved with the telephone, so, you know, I guess I was right. I mean, it's kind of gross, but interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, you've got written a number of books now, and I think you started off in sports writing, where you were very successful. Tell me about the transition from, say, sports writing to writing a novel. What was that like for you to have made that? And, of course, you've also written Tuesdays with Maury, which was a memoir. So these different genres, what kind of difficulties do they present for you?
As you pointed out, I was a sports writer for many years, and so nonfiction is very, very familiar to me. And I'm not thrown by that at all. And Tuesdays with Maury was a nonfiction book, and Have a Little Faith which was three books ago, was also a nonfiction book. So I moved back and forth between the different styles pretty comfortably. It was a bigger challenge to learn how to write a novel. And my first one was 10 years ago, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. And, you know, that I could say was, I wasn't sure I knew what I was doing until it came out and it was well received. And I've gotten better at that, I think, every book that I've put out. And this is now my fourth novel. So the whole difference between the two is just your imagination. You know, in nonfiction, you have to fight your imagination because you have to stick with what actually happened, and your imagination basically is limited to what words are you going to use to describe the true events that took place. But the events themselves are in stone. Whereas in fiction, your imagination becomes your enemy in a different way, in that it runs off at every little opportunity, and you have to kind of corral it back and say, well, come on, maybe he has a brother, maybe he has two brothers, maybe he has nine brothers, maybe he has 12 brothers, maybe he has six sisters. There's a point at which you have to sort of pick a lane and say, okay, this is the story I'm going to tell, and corral your imagination in. So, I try not to do two things at once. Like, I couldn't write a nonfiction book at the same time that I was writing a fiction book. I sort of put myself in the frame of mind that's required for that particular style and stay in it for a year or two. And then when I emerge, maybe I go back into the other one.
I know that you work with a lot of nonprofits and you've set up a lot of different philanthropic agencies. I think you also do some where you talk with up-and-coming writers and you give them advice.
Mm-hmm.
So how well received is it? You've got, you know, this sort of natural gift that a lot of people would really like. It's great to have that. And then if you have somebody who's maybe struggling a little bit more, it might be an interesting discussion.
Yeah, but I think that there's enough of writing that is a craft and not a gift,
right,
that you can pass on to people. And no matter where they are in their writing, you can help them and they can improve. You know, Stephen King is a friend of mine, and he wrote a very nice book about writing called On Writing. And it turned out, although, you know, Stephen is much better known for his horror stories and fiction, that book ended up becoming, you know, one of his most popular books because he was very basic in how he approached, okay, let's say you've never written anything before and you want to write something now. Here's how you begin. I think part of the problem with people who talk about writing, when they do it, they either feel compelled to or they only know how to do it on a very, very high literary level. And they feel like it's somehow beneath them or the world of writing to talk about, oh, okay, you've never written anything before. Here's how you name a character. Or here's what a plot is. Or here's what it is. And that's wrong. That's haughty. And that's a sense of privilege that you shouldn't have. The gift of writing, to me, is something that everybody should share and take part in. And it's not a question of if you don't do it well enough, don't do it. It's a question of wherever you are with it, there are ways to improve. And, you know, I deal with this with children in Haiti, where we operate an orphanage, and we're teaching them literally how to spell and how to, you know, begin to form sentences and then begin to, you know, tell us who they are, all the way up to graduate students in literary fiction who, you know, you try to just sort of tweak a little bit as opposed to the teaching them basics. So at any level, there's something to be learned, and I never stop learning. I talk to fellow writers all the time.
What is your favorite kind of people to work with when you're talking about all the folks that you've worked with across the ages? Is there one that you really particularly like to work with because it engages your imagination in a certain way?
I think my personal favorite is sort of people who are far enough along that they've got some imagination going, but, you know, still green enough that I can make a significant difference. I think once you, and that's probably teenage to early college age, I think once you sort of have found your voice, only you can kind of improve yourself, you know, or you know what it is that you're seeking, and it's the questions that you need answered, only certain people might be able to help you with. And I might, you know, someone who's already written several novels and are seeking to make them of a certain different quality or level, I might not be the right person to talk to because they're sort of in a different idiom than me or different genres. But when you're dealing with teenagers who have a lot of ideas and a lot of emotions, but they're still kind of green in how to get them down on paper, I think those are the ones I enjoy the most.
Okay. Now, this may be a difficult question to answer, but you live in Michigan, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's not a difficult question.
The second one, and you're a sports writer, and there's a team in Michigan, and there's a team in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
Tell me about your coverage of sports that have that kind of rivalry and background to it. Is that something that you look forward to doing? Or I will admit to being a little uneasy every time that time of year comes around.
I'm a little too deep into those wars to be uneasy with them anymore. I'm almost 30 years as a sports writer, and I've covered about the last 26 of them have been, I've dealt with the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry. So I actually enjoy it. I think it's all in good fun, and it's good to have that kind of emotion going into a game. But I clearly live in Michigan, and our bent is that we're happier when Michigan wins. But I'm not blinded to, if Ohio State is a superior team, I'm not going to never write that, or I'm not going to always whine and complain if Michigan loses. Oh, it had to be cheating or unfair. There are many years where Ohio State's just superior, and you have to say that. But when Michigan wins and they're doing better, I think there's probably a little bit more glee in all of our, not just my writing, but everyone at the newspaper. Because that's what sports is. But that's not bad. That's not at someone else's expense. It's the reason that when, Ohio State wins a national title, it's on the front page of the Columbus Dispatch in bold type, but when Ohio State loses the fourth game of the season to some, middle-of-the-road team, it's in the sports section, in a smaller version. I mean, there's a reason that things are blown out of proportion in sports, and it's because your emotion takes over.
Related to that, you've written a couple of books. The Timekeeper was another book that you've sort of recently published. And I was thinking about The Timekeeper and The First Phone Call from Heaven in the ways that you're dealing with loss and making up time. The Timekeeper's central thesis is being obsessed with time and what that can do to you. So I'm interested in if you think that that's a theme that you're going to continue with, because the loss and the timing sorts of themes, if that's something that's coming out in your next book, because I read these two books sort of back to back, and first maybe that was the reason that I saw a lot of the same things being dealt with, somebody really concerned with time and loss.
Yeah, well, I think ever since Tuesdays with Maury, those have been themes that have sort of woven through my books. It's not just time and loss, it's meaning, of our lives. It's our connectivity with one another. It's do the things we do matter? It's trying to make up for lost chances. It's forgiveness. It's a lot of themes that I discussed with Maury when I was sitting by his side. We did kind of week-by-week lessons in what's important in life once you realize you're going to die. And many of these things are exactly that, those subjects that you mentioned. How are you going to spend your time? How do you deal with the losses in your life? How do you deal with forgiveness? How do you make your life matter? So these are the themes that interest me, but, I'm not a self-help writer, and I'm not writing, chapter one, here's how you find meaning in your life. It's more stories that when you're done reading them, you realize that you're thinking about those themes through the eyes of the characters and the plot and the mystery and all that. And that's what I do. I mean, no different than, hey, John Grisham writes about a lot of lawyers, Did everybody notice that? There's always a lawyer in one of his books. That's right. What he does. And, but he uses those lawyers to tell the stories that he wants to tell. And behind his stories are, usually some kind of triumph of good over evil in some way. And there are other people who deal with military themes and other people who deal with horror and all this. So this is just sort of my idiom, I guess. And I think maybe it sometimes confounds people a little bit because not too many people do it. And so it doesn't fit easily. It's not like, oh, well, you're just like, you know, this guy, this guy, this guy. And I recognize that, which is fine. And so this is why I end up spending time talking about it. But I've never considered myself a person who writes about death or loss. I consider myself someone who writes about life and writes about hope and how you find that element in life and how you find some meaning to it. It just seems that unless you deal with mortality and you know, your time running out, people don't really give credence to those issues. It's only when, you know, suddenly we realize we're going to die that we realize, oh, maybe I should have lived my life a little bit differently. And so I find that that theme kind of runs through my books, and that's what connects.
Mitch Albom, I thank you very much for talking to me today on Craft. Again, the book is The First Phone Call from Heaven. Is it safe to assume you're in the midst of writing another book?
Well, it's more like the beginning than the midst, but yes, you always start working on your next one about the 5 minutes after the last one has been printed. So
you only get five minutes. It's only five minutes.
Yeah, I give myself a five-minute break, and then I get going again.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and you have a great day.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Bye-bye.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.